Entente. It's that time of the morning when the suburbs are pure, stripped clean, and the birds are out. Not changing the subject, whatever it is. With sometimes a rush of song, as one by one they fit into their feathers. Just now, there's one who chatters, never stops. And there's one who listens, occasionally answers. An audience of one is enough.
I became inspired to start writing poetry around 1965 through reading the Penguin Book of Australian Verse with my then boyfriend. I suppose typically at that point I was helping him with his MA thesis on a neglected Australian poet. I wasn't thinking of myself as being a poet, but he was my mentor, and in the excitement of reading those Australian poems, I decided I was going to write some of this stuff. School and home, always supportive, but pretty uninfluential as far as giving an impetus to my writing poetry. The family's always been wonderful in helping me when I've been on my trips back promoting my books. I'd had a very British-oriented education, and that included British poetry, Wordsworth, Daffodils, and Shelley, and so on.
Hedge. I am in love with its brazenness, ferocity that opens up the sun. Forsythia, my first hedge planted with roots pillaged from a neighbouring tip. I have watched it spread, flag its statement. A yellow furore, velvet star flowers to throw in the air, give to passers-by. Hedge fire, this harvest I revel in, where gold is traversed by sun, and the thicket locks me into birdsong. I have been waiting for this special rain, its sudden flux, lemon butter madness, the flare of it showering over full stems. Gold in the hand, mesmeric glints to shelter in, a saffron-walled room en plein air, an alfresco walk through known treasure. Here is a riot, undeclared, tree certainty, tree silence. Each year, a new layer as it spreads its yellow, further, further. Summer Odyssey. Between green lanes and the new river's 400-year-old waterway, between ghost Victorian railway cottages and terraces fronting Umfraville Road, between the past and present's waiting shell, lies a rectangular patch of woodland and hedgerow, railway fields, broken by grassland where young foxes frisk in the evenings. An ecotone oasis where city tar meets woodland, meadow, scrub, splendid with chalet, pond, lavender and briar, bees on bramble, cinnabar on tansy, till you feel blown away to views on the river. This year, railway fields is running away with itself. Daily, the Budleyers' mauve lasers draw the speckled wood, peacock, large white, hedge brown, small white, red admiral, and common blue. At the back of the pond, yellow flag irises, shading the newts, claim the sun, as do butterflies racing into the maze of bumblebees, ladybirds, and damselflies. Along the hedge boundary, the field maple, oldest tree here, loops back a century and more. Under threat. February. Already catkins. Hanging green fires. Coppices heady by Mutton Brook stream. And paths bathed in wood scent. The sweep of 800-year-old hedges. Knotted. Tuned. Islands fledging green under the sky's grey shell. First shoots gathering like clans reassembling, knowing how the mouth of the sky is lowering itself to them in this suburban patch under threat. Its mosaic of bluebells and sycamore, habitat of bat, stoat, mole, to be diced, delivered up only to memory, its sliding doors gaining momentum.
I suppose I had many different influences, but especially in the beginning, I was like a scavenger, just looking for ideas wherever I got them. I studied poets such as Yeats and Ruth Daw and Judith Wright, Vincent Buckley, all very public poets. And Judith Wright was particularly important. I call her my poetry godmother because I was at one of those Armadale conferences on Australian literature, and she looked at some of my poems and she was encouraging and said, "Keep going, you've got something there." It was just the sort of thing I needed to hear. And then just gradually I kept going on and reading Australian magazines, even though I was overseas. And people like Barry Reid and John McLaren were great encouragers of my writing, alongside later Judith Rodriguez and others in the growing band of Australian women poets. You know, it's been a great adventure in a sense. In 1969, a lot changed. I came overseas and I became much more influenced by the women's movement, with the range of anthologies coming out of the US in particular. And that was all very important for giving me new directions. Well, as a novice, I was very keen to learn. And another thing that was important, we didn't have workshops then in the 60s and early 70s, as happened later. Nowadays, everybody goes to workshops, well, just about. And so I sort of was on my learning treadmill. It's the sort of thing that takes a long time. Obviously, I've kept in touch with Australian poetry, as well as trying to get into British and American and anybody else's who's going. This is one thing about being overseas. The impact of moving was enormous, particularly from the outsider viewpoint, you know, getting a sense of our Australian-British history, the intertwinings, and seeing Australia from over here. Because a lot of people, you know, think that once you leave, you're a long way from home, but you're still part of the scene. And in one of my early poems, which was in my Fish Rings on Water book, I wrote a poem called Farewell Poem. It was really about a relationship. And, you know, I was thinking about the fact of having originally planned to be away for 12 months, you know, couldn't stay away longer. But finally, my impetus was getting away from an unhappy relationship. Actually, and this poem, Farewell Poem, somehow sums up my situation. It would be my first trip, thousands of miles past a dread of leaving. I saw Australia draped Dali style on a thread. That's an excerpt from it. Another poem, At Delphi, was also about leaving that relationship.
Delphi. Clouded yellows, red admirals, others I cannot name, weaving in and out of bindweed, daisies, buttercups. They've flown over wide sea stretches to reach these wild grasses, tombs and ruins. I breathe the scented air, feel the sky's silk, there for the taking. I can almost unknot my unhappiness, see how its underside is the impossible love I've carried all this way, like spare, necessary baggage. Can I ungrip it, leave it here for random gods to give one last blessing? I hear your voice urging me on to walk through this steady fire of butterflies.
Well, I was in England for 2 years, but part of that was travelling, of course. There was so much to see. In fact, too much to see. Then in 1971, they brought in restrictions against Commonwealth people in London, staying in Britain. And I had a brother in Paris, and he found me a job teaching English. Well, that was a great experience. And particularly from the point of view of art, Paris is a city of art. I wrote a book of poems, my first collection actually, published as The Eye Circle, and it was using the eye as a persona. The influence of painting on my work has always been there, and I think being overseas and having the chance to go to lots of exhibitions, it became a lasting influence. In my latest collection, Circus Apprentice, I did a series of poems after Kandinsky, and I used as epigraph, when you arrive at a state of shock, the paradox of colour will balance you. And that actually was from an earlier poem in 1970 when I saw my first Kandinsky exhibition. It's been exciting doing those Kandinsky poems because they were published in a separate collection by Vagabond Press, and also part of them were put to music, and we've performed them at the Australian Studies Centre, which is one of my marvellous home away from home places in London. A couple of years after first going there, I met my husband Bernard, and life became history, as it were. But Paris was an enormous influence.
Yellow, red, blue. Watch the animal eyes that whisk corners faster than an angel breathing passwords in a mesh of yellow. Cloud shore, life flags itself on. Circle after circle is mapped in the mystery of a line quicker than an arrow, shot from left to right. The dark corners turned in on themselves, while the sea advances up the cliffs. Presently, a cat walks tall out of the waves, eyes open, heading for the fire at the centre. The red waves fanned, turned crimson, surrounded by purples that ferry the jigsaw's spell. Choices multiply, resonate, form patterns for love songs the heart claims again and again. In the background, dark moons, resilient, juggle patchwork squares, lines, and curves. Light bounces off them as finally the perfect blue you've been waiting for dips, tumbles into the still of the storm, among reds, purples, all shades. This country you keep coming back to, that walks you home to yourself. Balancing. Shearing into extremes, prime colours that reach back to childhood, crayons and paints that you flew everywhere, sometimes colouring inside the lines, sometimes splashing on a blank slate, allowing sun to be orange, black, or green, waves to be carmine, tipped with blue. Traffic isn't one way in this quick-eyed adventure between earth and sky. Moons sit sublime, harness a catalogue of randomness, signal where to land. To live in the house of colours is to spark cadences in the corners of your heart. Everything translated for its verve and flow.
We came here to live in London in 1979. It was wonderful to be back speaking English all the time. Of course, there are plenty of people in Paris who speak English, but a writer needs to hear his or her own language all the time. London is such an active, wonderful place. My poem Hybrid attempts to look at the positives of this kind of duality. The divided identity, it's an enormous subject, and there are more and more hybrids around, but it carries difficulties, particularly with regard to book publication. Again, I've had considerable support in getting published from both hemispheres, in fact, particularly in Australia. Professor Elizabeth Webby, who is Professor of Australian Literature at Sydney University, she's always been a great supporter. And again, over here, there have been different ones, including my current publishers, ARC Publications, who've now got a distributor, Eleanor Brash. But anyway, the situation for poetry written in English by women has changed globally. Women occasionally win the Nobel Prize. In the UK, we've just had the appointment of Caroline Duffy as the first woman poet laureate. And that's wonderful. It's because she's dynamic and lively and really keen to promote poetry, including by women. Because, you know, it's fairly recent that women's poetry has had such a public profile. That can only be a good thing.
Thank you. hybrid. I have swallowed a country. It sits quietly inside me. Days go by when I scarcely realize it is there. I talk to this country, tell it, you're not forgotten, nor ever could be. I depend on you. Cornucopia packed close with daylight moons and bony coasts. The dust of eucalyptus on my teeth. Muddied rivers burnished smooth under the cobalt crystal of a lucent sky. It is my reference point for other landscapes that, after 30 years, have multiplied my skies. Itinerant. Polishing my square-toed brogues, I think about journey, that measure of breaking out of myself which never leaves me. I catch each venture like a living thing. Improvised, it cuts free, shoe inviting, pressing the day. My heart drums fast, faster. I tell myself, your feet have never failed you. Whatever happens, the journey's always there. Sometimes dark, sometimes clear, the way, on this road you're wedded to, a mountain will appear, climbing suddenly out of a wall of mist.
One of the things about travelling, it does sharpen your eye, perhaps, anyway. And my poem, Hybrid, and also Itinerant, and Gwen John Swims the Channel, those are poems that talk about the expatriate experience. Gwen John Swims the Channel, well, she's a Welsh poet who came back to the UK, obviously, very famous family. Her brother, Augustus John, was also very well known, but Gwen stayed in Paris. She was very shy, but my poem, Gwen John Swims the Channel, I imagine her as coming back daily, swimming the channel daily, because she takes her energies and her recognitions from where she originated. And in the poem, she's on her way back, and that's where it leaves it. The channel is a very vigorous, dangerous swim, but she does it daily, leaving Paris behind her.
Gwen John Swims the Channel. September 3, 1939. Early evening, and the sea soughs, sways. A sketchbook washing calm, its ribs carrying the meticulous rainy births, portraits from her many lives. She has always loved the coastline, come back to it, the waves' fringed grip. Daily swimming the channel, testing herself against its heave and push. Ahead, Dover's scribbly white cliffs, and beyond, the hills of Tenby, its beaches curve, her childhood's patch of sand. She has tested this sea's glass and painted herself into its mirror like a cloud passing over. She has more interiors to match and place. Place and match, as again she gives herself to the water. its moody mountain surging, pacing her. The archetypal swimmer planing darkness, with the coast clearing and Paris Meudon behind her.
I suppose my poetry covers a range of subjects. I'm very keen on poetry about the environment, and I like to follow Robert Frost's idea of a fresh look and a fresh listen. That's what poetry is. And also that you're trying to give people the shock of recognition. Those two things. And certainly I've got a lot of identification with nature, having grown up on a farm where life was never easy as far as the weather goes, particularly, and they've just had another awful drought while we're still on in Australia. And my poem, Dancing on the Farm, and Cloud Eye, about my parents, but Dancing on the Farm particularly, is a poem for my dad, who seemed to always be affected by the droughts and the problems of the weather. Again, though, it's an environmentally edged poem.
Dancing on the Farm. I wanted to dance with my father, dance fast over dirt tracks, dance full flight across creeks, breeze past the watching crows, surprise every sheep and cow. Jazz waltz, foxtrot, jive, to find some joie de vivre that seemed to pass him by. At my first bush dance, he pulled me to my feet, saved me from being a wallflower. His way to say, caring. He was master of the slow waltz. I'd seen his cool toe balancing, the grace of it, guiding my mother into circles of Lahar and Strauss. But the foxtrot, too fast, he shrugged. I'm past it. I didn't believe him, standing there on the edge of my dream, with his face slightly pained, as if giving bad news. And the gentle side of him spoke, a look that said he was vulnerable. My dad opened up, the weight of days holding his feet to the boards. Cloud Eye. The sting in a limbering spring day foreshadows summer. Through her window, roses plait themselves together beside young-leafed eucalypts as she, too ill to speak, slowly becomes my eye in the clouds, the gap I will see through. No one knows me better than she who circled my first flight. I've tried to prepare myself, remembering her cyclopedic mind, her gift for solutions. My bird mother. I reach out, hold her hands. She slides down into sleep and wakes again on this final island, where touch is more important than words. She grimaces, begs for morphine. Our world divides. We'll fly differently now. Tanker for a hero. Brave Monsieur Pongyong, with a quarter of a heart, his blood running cold. He eats for the inner man, can't believe the state he's in. It's always the same, his struggle to the clinic for a transfusion. The doctors give him hard hope, and the nurses crisp their smiles. He takes it on the chin, believes life's today's tipple, as his heart gears up a season of good whiskey and meshes a young man's fire. In the resistance, he marched into the front line, wore his cocky cap, filleting secrets that lost, sometimes won, the local wars. When his friends visit, they rarely talk old battles, daredevil escapes, the risks of that other time, its do-or-die calendar. Monsieur Pongyong knows he has carried his chances, his blood so thin now, and he is left hard-memoried. Encircling his life, this death.
One of the things, I suppose, as my work has gone on, it's become less obviously autobiographical, but transforming the biographical to take new directions. My books have always followed a thematic journey, if you like. I'm finding, or always looking for ways of using other voices and making it new, at least as far as possible. The poem Circus Apprentice is the title of my most recent book. And some people have asked me why this title. Well, it's a metaphor for the world situation, the world circus. And again, as a hybrid mixture, I'm still very conscious of being a member of Australia here and the world. And the circus is a metaphor for that. In fact, when I introduce this poem, I usually say, "You're never too old to be a circus apprentice." It gets a laugh, but it's also got its ironies. And of course, another aspect of the poem is the dependence of the circus participant on the audience, especially the last three lines. I must say, this poem came out of focusing on the circus, on all the different activities, but it grew over a period of time, a few years. Circus Apprentice. I'm learning it all. Acrobatics, clowning, riding bareback and trapeze. Fire from a sleeve, my hands a wand. I weave my life round dancing elephants who spray the air while turning their backs on the crowd. Lions who never put a foot wrong. I'm taking their cue. I've seen what people want. Prancing ponies teach me steps, pacing, adroitness, like my fellow dancers keeping their spot. I'm walking the high wire, making my mark, poised, balanced, don't look away. You are my gravity's other edge.